everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And there is nothing more important these days than getting truly informed. So I'm so glad you're joining me today because I have another really wonderful conversation that is going to help create so much more awareness about how we really need to take care of our bodies, particularly how to get our hormones in balance. And it's not just for the women listening, it's for the men as well. So we have some great information in store for you today. Before I get there and before I introduce my guest to you, I just want to be sure that you know how to get my archived copies of these interviews so you don't really miss out on any of them. And the best way to do that is either go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and like me over there, or you can go right to my website, Dr. Cheryl Selman, that's drcherylselman.com, and opt into my newsletter, which sends all of these archive shows out, as well as other, you know, other great information that I come across from time to time. And I also wanted everyone to know that I have another show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. called The Love Code, and that's more of a spiritual program. It's really an opportunity to have conversations with variety of spiritual teachers and masters and people with healing gifts and personal experiences of healing that really are designed to uplift us, transform us, really connect us to the power that we have, connect us to our hearts, connect us to the ability to truly heal ourselves. So I hope you'll be joining me on both of these programs. And if you either go to my Facebook page, What Women Must Know, or go to Dr. Cheryl Selman and opt into my website, you'll get both of those weekly programs. So hope you'll be joining me. Lots of great conversations will be had. And let's talk about a great conversation because I have a wonderful guest with me today, and we're going to be talking about the new science of food, hormones, and health. And this is the topic of the latest book by Dr. Neil Barnard called Your Body in Balance, and just a little bit about my guest. Dr. Barnard is president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a faculty member of George Washington University School of Medicine, and a fellow of the American College of Cardiology. In 2016, he founded Barnard Medical Center in Washington, D.C., to create a new model that integrates nutrition into conventional medical care. His federally funded diabetes research revolutionized the nutritional approaches to type 2 diabetes, and he now aims to empower readers with life-changing information on hormones and health. He has written 19 books on nutrition and health, and his very latest book, hot off the press, is Your Body in Balance, The New Science of Food, Hormones, and Health. So, having said all that, it's such a pleasure to welcome Dr. Neil Barnard to the show today. Hello and welcome.
Thank you. Great to be with you today.
Well, it's great having you. You are such a pioneer in this area of health and nutrition, and I mean, to be federally funded, I didn't know that you actually got that federal funds for diabetes research and looking at nutrition. That's wonderful, and it's probably a little belated, but never too late to congratulate you on being able to achieve that and really helping the betterment of all of us as a result. Okay, so my first question to you, I mean, you have a traditional training as an orthodox medical doctor. What happened to you on the road to your personal journey here that led you to be so committed to nutrition and to incorporate nutrition in your healing, in your work, your teaching, in your writing, and your other modalities? What was that pivotal moment for you?
Well, there were several things, but one of the first really was the year before I went to medical school, I was working in a Minneapolis hospital as the autopsy assistant, meaning when somebody would die in the hospital, I had to help out at the examination to determine the cause of death. And the pathologist knew that I was going to be going to medical school, so every autopsy was a lecture. And one day we had a man who died in the hospital of a massive heart attack, maybe from eating hospital food, but that's another story. You know? Anyway, so I had to prepare the body for the examination. examination, and the pathologist removed a huge section of ribs from the front of the chest to expose the heart. And he had me look at the coronary arteries, and he said they're called coronary because they crown the heart. And he sliced one of them open and showed me the inside, and it was just filled with what we call atherosclerotic plaque. And he said, of course, you know, that's your bacon and eggs, Neil. This, you know, that's cholesterol and so forth that people eat. That's what causes this problem. And then we looked at the carotid arteries going to the brain and the femoral arteries going to the legs, and they all had the same issue. So it was very much an eye-opener. And then at the end of the exam, he left the room, and I had to clean everything up. So I put the rib back in the chest and sewed up the skin, and then I went up to the cafeteria when I was done, and they were serving ribs for lunch. Yeah, they were serving ribs for lunch, and it looked like the dead body that I had been working on, and it smelled like it. And I thought, I am not going to eat that. I just couldn't. It was, and you wouldn't call that a health decision or an ethical decision. It was just kind of this gut feeling that that is not healthy. So anyway, then I began medical school, and we started to learn more and more things. And as time went on, I started to discover that foods give us power that you would never have guessed, you know, to improve diabetes, which we had thought was sort of genetic, or my more recent work, menstrual cramps and endometriosis and PCOS and fertility issues and hormone-related cancers. These are all things where you would think there can't be a role for what I ate for breakfast, but it turns out that that is the most decisive thing. And my feeling was, if women don't know about this, if men don't know about this, then they do not have the power that they need to have to help themselves and to help their family.
Well, it's so good to hear you say that. I mean, that you've, you know, working with the hormones at this point, this is something that I've been working with. You know, I'm losing track. It's, you know, 25 years or so. My first book came out called Hormone Heresy, What Women Must Know About Their Hormones, and that was 96 or something. I mean, so I've been working on this for a long time, too, trying to help people to understand what's really driving hormonal imbalance and how we can bring harmony back to our hormones. And everything we've been told, just about everything we've been told about how our body works, how our hormones are created, what goes on with our hormones, I have found to be inaccurate or wrong. So if you don't have that basic information, it's really hard to make wise decisions to support your health and fertility. So this is, you know, this is a passion of mine, and I'm just looking forward to our conversation because I know you are adding more pieces to this important puzzle. Maybe a very good place to start is to let's start with the basics and help women, and we're going to get to you guys soon, so don't go away. So we'll start with the women. Can you give us kind of a basic understanding, a basic primer of what's going on with our hormones? What are they, and how do they work, and what's a menstrual cycle? Can we start really basic with that kind of information?
Sure, and I have to say I was kind of inducted into this by accident. I was sitting at my desk and the phone rang, and it was a young woman who had menstrual pain. And many women have menstrual pain, but for perhaps 1 in 10, it is so off the scale painful that you can't go to school, you can't go to work, and that was her situation. And I started thinking about how we need to go beyond painkillers. You know, a painkiller's fine. You know, that's helpful. That's often essential. But if food could get things back in balance, that could prevent this from happening in the future. And so we actually, in this patient, I did suggest some diet changes, which we then later tested in a randomized clinical trial with our colleagues at Georgetown University, and it really works. So anyway, just to back up and what's going on with the woman's cycle. If you look at...
And then we'll get to that protocol that you recommended.
Yes. Yes, okay. You bet. Which I have to say was just an educated guess at the time, but it's wonderful that it turned out to be correct. Anyway, at the beginning of a month, a woman has very little estrogen in her blood. Estrogen is the hormone that's made in the ovaries, and it goes to the uterus and gets it ready for pregnancy. Kind of in the same way as in a man's body, the testes produce testosterone, which gets in his bloodstream and it goes to his brain and makes him want to run for president, I guess. anyway, okay, we're not talking politics here. The ovaries produce estrogens, and other parts of the body do as well, and there's very little estrogen in the first 2 weeks. After about 2 weeks, it peaks and it falls very rapidly. That's ovulation, when the ovary is releasing an egg. But then over the next 7 days or so, roughly, the amount of estrogen rises to a new peak, and it's doing it because the uterus is the most optimistic organ in the body. Every single month, it's convinced, this is going to be the big one. We're going to be pregnant this month. I can just feel it. And so what it's doing is that estrogen is, what it's doing now is it's thickening up the inner lining of the uterus. It's called the endometrium. That's the inner lining of the uterus, and it's thickening it up to get ready for pregnancy. But then after a week or so, the disappointed uterus discovers we're not pregnant again, darn it. And so then the amount of estrogen falls, and that thickened inner lining, that endometrial layer, is discarded in menstrual flow. And then it all starts again the next month. So here's the problem. Let's say a woman has pretty bad cramps, and she's really feeling crummy. What we believe is happening is that extra estrogen activity is thickening up the endometrial lining too much, so that at the end of the month, when it disintegrates in menstrual flow, it releases maladjusted chemicals called prostaglandins that cause pain. So when the young woman called me, what I was envisioning is that she, for whatever reason, she had too much estrogenic activity causing too much thickening, too much pain at the end of the month. And when the endometrial lining thickens up and it causes these prostaglandins to form, they cause pain, and they also get in your bloodstream and they go to your brain and make you feel rotten, and they're really unhelpful. So here's the good part. That we know there are certain foods that aggravate this problem, and when you get them out of your diet, you're going to get better. There are also other foods that help you, and when you get them into your diet, you're going to get better. And it's pretty easy to figure them out. The at the top of my bad list is America's favorite food, and that is cheese. Everybody loves cheese, but when you look at what's in it, it came from milk. The milk came from a cow who was pregnant. For most of the time, cows are pregnant 9 months out of every 12 on dairies, and pregnant animals make estrogens that are a match for your own. They make progesterone, and it gets, these hormones get into milk. They're concentrated in cheese, and you're swallowing it with every slice of pizza. That will add to the estrogenic effect in your body. And then on the good side, let me sing praises for vegetables and fruits and beans and grains, because the roughage that they have, the fiber that they have, is part of the process of extracting excess estrogens out of your body and taking them away so that you can get back into balance. So that's kind of in a nutshell how hormones are affected by food.
So just there are a couple of really important points that you've made, and this is the problem of the estrogens, and really, well, there's so many sources now more than ever before of how we are raising estrogen levels through the plastics, chemicals in our water. Obviously, certain foods are, like you were saying, the milk products have the estrogens in them. And an estrogen in itself, when it's out of balance, I believe, is very pro-inflammatory. Am I correct in assuming that, Dr. Bernard?
I think that's a fair statement, because and prostaglandins play a key role in all of this, in all of this process. So yes. And people are, unfortunately, are encouraged to eat the wrong foods. When a seven-year-old child is thinking, well, should I eat the M&Ms or the cheese? You know, they're well-meaning but ill-informed parents say, well, cheese, it's got protein, it's got calcium, it's, you know, it's good for you. That's 100% marketing. That product has no role in human health at all. Cow's milk is designed by nature, if I can use that word, to nourish a calf. It's not there for a human baby or adult or anybody, and humans have just taken advantage of this product and turned it into things that are a bit addictive, but they don't advance health at all. So maybe back to the case that I described earlier, the young woman who called me up, I suggested to her that she follow a completely vegan diet, meaning no animal products at all, no dairy, no meat, nothing, and also keep oils really low. So even what you'd think of as healthy oils, to keep them to a bare minimum. And that was her cure. The reason that we do that is that there are really three parts of this. One is dairy increases estrogens. The other is any kind of fat seems to increase estrogens, and high fiber foods, that's plant foods, seem to make it go down. So the best diet is one that has no animal products in it at all and keeps oils pretty low.
Oh, wow. So that sounds so interesting. I can understand fiber. I think fiber really is important for clearing out excess estrogens, and which really sets so many of the hormonal issues into play. This imbalance. I mean, estrogen in proper balance is essential for many things. But if you're experiencing hormonal imbalances, and this is true for men, we're looking at this excess of estrogen that is driving these unnatural symptoms and conditions going on. And and I think it's more of a problem than ever before for, everything we've talked about in the food, it's in the water. And so this imbalance has been created that generates all these inflammatory conditions and unnatural processes and unnatural timing of hormones and relationships of hormones.
Hormones are, it's a striking thing that hormones are necessary but also potentially very dangerous. If you don't have, take thyroid hormone, which you need for energy. If you don't have any, it's not compatible with life. If you have too much, it can kill you. Same with insulin. If you don't have any insulin, that's the hormone that brings sugar into cells. If you don't have any, you will die. If you have too much, you will die. Estrogen is the same way. If you have too much estrogen in your blood, you're at much higher risk for breast cancer that can kill you. So in all cases, hormones have an essential role, but they have to be in the right balance. And the balance is different for different people in the sense that for a man, estrogens in even a modest increase will reduce his sperm count, for example. So cheese-eating men, by the way, have much lower sperm counts compared to men who don't eat cheese. Again, we believe it's the estrogens. They're on your side when you're in balance, but they're very dangerous when they're out of balance.
Right. Absolutely. So while we're talking about estrogens a bit and clearing estrogens, I have really looked into the role of the liver in clearing estrogens and in metabolizing estrogens properly. So you kind of deactivate them and don't turn them into more dangerous forms of estrogen that can fuel all sorts of estrogen-like problems, including breast cancer. And that's the role of foods in the cruciferous family. Maybe it's a good time we can talk about that a little bit, how cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower, that whole family actually can help in the proper clearing of estrogens out of the body rather than accumulating them or making them even more dangerous through that impaired detoxification process. Can we talk a bit about that?
Yeah, let me sing broccoli's praises for a minute, actually.
Whole
cruciferous family. The whole cruciferous family, it's got many attributes. It's got loaded with highly absorbable calcium, and it's got iron in its best form, and it's got all kinds of great stuff. But one of the things it'll do, maybe two things for the liver, your liver is there to clean your blood, and it has enzyme systems that do it. And some of these enzymes will recognize chemicals that your liver decides don't belong in you. And sometimes it's a little excessive, like you're taking a medication that you want to be in your bloodstream, and the liver will clear that out too. But the point being that if you have the right enzymes in your liver, it will help rid you of certain things, including excess estrogens. So let's say you ate broccoli today, or Brussels sprouts, or other cruciferous vegetables. Within 24 to 48 hours, you have more of what are called phase 2 enzymes. And the phase 2 enzymes help you to rid your body of toxins. And these can include even toxins that you might inhale or ingest in foods. But there's another piece of this, and that's that the liver will remove excess hormones from the blood, excess estrogens, for example, sends them through what's called the bile duct, which is a little tube that goes to your intestine, and then out they go with the waste. So you're taking the excess estrogens out of the blood, down the bile duct, into the intestine, gone. You're literally flushing them away. But let's say you are broccoli phobic, and you're not eating your fruits, or beans. And so you're not eating vegetables or fruits very much, and you're eating salmon and chicken breast and omelets. Animal products don't have any fiber. And if you don't have fiber, the hormones don't go down the toilet. They end up being reabsorbed back through your gut wall into your circulation. So a high fiber diet is essential. And the best of these are diets where everything that you're eating is from a plant. That's what maximizes the fiber intake. So beans, which our grandparents knew about, but we kind of forgot about, vegetables and fruits and whole grains, those are really the essential part of your estrogen elimination pathway.
Yeah, so you know, this is such important information. We need to get back to nature and to understand that the processed foods that we're eating and the excess of sugars and synthetic foods, and I obviously because of your research and what you believe, it's too much meat and cheese is a processed food actually. Because of our diet, and which adds to the numerous other things that are stressing our system out right now, is driving this imbalance that's showing up as hormonal issues. And I always say to my patients that all hormonal symptoms are symptoms of imbalance. So we have to quit saying, you know, it's I've got this condition, I've got, you know, I've got fibroids, I've got what I said. It's like it's telling you, it's a message that you're out of balance, and we need to then start addressing all of those key pieces in your life to bring you back into balance. So we have to start with diet. That's a really fundamental place to start in understanding what's driving this hormonal imbalance that can lead to weight gain, it can lead to more inflammation going on, and these hormonal imbalances between the other hormones as well. So let's talk about some specific conditions that I know you have written about and are concerned about and are huge problems. And we can talk about endometriosis, fibroids, and let's talk about polycystic ovarian syndrome. Let's throw all those three into the mix and
sure.
Have a conversation.
Sure. With endometriosis, in fact, let me just share a patient anecdote. This is a young woman named Catherine who was in the Air Force. And, in fact, she was over in Iraq starting in 2003 with the beginning of the conflict there, and because she built military bases. And when you're in a war zone and you eat what the military gives you, you don't really gain a lot of weight. You know, you're working really hard. But once her tour of duty was finished and they shipped her back stateside, she started pigging out on, to use her word, on foods that she had missed when she was over there. And that meant macaroni and cheese this. And she especially liked cheese, but lots of animal products and so forth. Two things happened. She started gaining weight, but she also started developing a lot of pain in her abdomen that turned out to be endometriosis. And for people who are not aware, what the condition means is that cells that should be lining your uterus, that's the endometrial cells, cells in the endometrium, they have somehow escaped. We think they go up the fallopian tubes, and they implant. They can grab a hold of your intestinal tract or implant on your ovaries or on the fallopian tubes, and they cause terrible pain, in some cases excruciating pain, and they can also lead to infertility. And that was her situation. And nothing was getting her better at all. And finally the doctor said, well, let's do a hysterectomy. And she said, well, I'm 27, you know, and my husband and I are kind of newlyweds, and, you know, we haven't raised our family yet. And the doctor said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, but based on my exam of you, you are very likely infertile anyway. So, okay, I'm in constant pain. Nothing's working. Medications aren't helping. The hysterectomy is the only thing, and there's no downside anymore. So fair enough. She scheduled it for six weeks later. But before she could have the operation, a friend convinced her to see a nutrition expert who looked at her diet and convinced her to begin a diet that was very much like the one that I had described earlier for the menstrual pain patient. Vegan, you know, no animal products, oils low, natural foods, unprocessed stuff. And she started feeling better. But when 6 weeks arrived, she dutifully reported to the hospital and was anesthetized for the procedure. And about an hour later, she woke up in the recovery room with the surgeon shaking her shoulder, saying, "Catherine, I want you to wake up. I need to talk to you." And the surgeon said, "Your endometriosis is effectively gone. You have a lot of scarring left. You had some adhesions that I had to free up. But once I've done that, I don't think you're going to have any pain anymore. You don't have any endometriosis anymore." And, you know, her mother was in the room with her, and her mother said, "Well, she made some pretty big diet changes. She's vegan now," and so forth. And the doctor wasn't having any of it. He said, "No, foods do not cause endometriosis, and there's no way that a diet change could make it go away. This can only be explained by a miracle."
It's more logical to have a miracle than diet, right?
Right. Well, first of all, I want to praise this doctor for one thing. He looked inside and saw she didn't need a hysterectomy, and he left her uterus in place.
Yes.
So good on him. You know, he could have done the operation. He did not. And that's good. But what's not so good is he didn't think about this, that endometriosis is driven by estrogen, the female sex hormone, and foods can drive estrogen. So he missed that part of it. So anyway, she lost a ton of weight. She still has a uterus. She no longer has endometriosis. She gave birth to a child, and then a second child, and then a third child. So she was not infertile after all. And she is now one of our Food for Life instructors to teach other women how to take their health back. So endometriosis is a condition where these cells are there, and if you can get your estrogen level back into balance, we believe that many, many women will improve with this. Now, what has not yet happened is there has not been a randomized clinical trial of women with endometriosis using a low-fat vegan diet versus some kind of placebo. That really should happen. But in the meanwhile, there is no reason for a woman not to do this diet. Do a hormone-taming diet and see if you can spare yourself the surgery and medications.
And I have had those kind of results as well, where we can really reverse things like endometriosis, which are conditions that traditional medical approaches can't do anything with, actually, at all. And and it often results in a hysterectomy, which is so sad. So this is such good news, and I hope everyone listening is really getting the message here, because we can address these conditions. We can turn them around. Let's go on and talk about fibroids, because fibroids happen to be, I believe, the number one reason why women have hysterectomies, and can lead to the biggest problem, of course, they can get large and they can put pressure on different organ systems. And then can result in being so uncomfortable that they have to be taken out. And often, you don't have to have a hysterectomy, right, if you have a fibroid, but often it is what is done to women. There are other ways you can take those masses out. But let's talk about that. Let's give some hope on that front.
Right. Well, first of all, what a fibroid is, the inner lining of the uterus is this soft endometrium, and just outside that is this a muscular layer, the muscles that make the uterus firm and strong. And that muscle layer can get little muscle knots in it, and those are fibroids. They're collections of muscles that grow, and sometimes they're small like a pea, sometimes they're bigger like a marble, and sometimes they're big like a tangerine. And they can either be asymptomatic or they can hurt. And they can cause all kinds of symptoms, including just a pressure. And they are fueled by estrogens. And so if they're not too symptomatic, and a woman just waits till menopause, they're going to gradually shrink, and they're going to go away. So that's good. Weight loss can help, we believe, because body fat makes estrogens too. Which may surprise people, but fat cells are not just dormant collections of calories. Fat cells are active factories that make estrogens. And by the way, they do that in men's bodies too. If a man has breast enhancement as he's gained weight, that's because of the estrogens in his body produced by his body fat. And then finally, everything that we said that relates to menstrual pain relates to fibroids too. That cheese is dumping estrogens into your blood. High-fiber foods are taking them out, Fatty foods are elevating estrogens too, for reasons we don't know. And when I say fatty foods, I mean chicken, burgers, salmon. I mean extra virgin olive oil. I mean all fats seem to contribute to estrogen excesses. You need a certain amount of fat in your diet, but you don't need the excess, and you never need animal fat. So we would use the same prescription, dietary prescription, for fibroids that we would use for menstrual pain. That's avoiding animal products, keeping oils low. But there has never been a good randomized trial for fibroids like the one that we did for primary menstrual pain.
And the thing about fibroids is that you really want to address them early on, because when they get really large, it's hard to eliminate them, actually. Then you know, you need a procedure of some sort if they start putting pressure on various organs. So you want to really address them early on in life. And, you know, Dr. Penn, I have found that the theory is that as you get older and your estrogen, because you have to go through menopause, that fibroids will decrease. I don't find that necessarily true, because of the estrogen dominant profile that we have these days in women and in men, but fibroids, of course, related to women, that often estrogen dominance is a continuing condition that happens into menopause, especially if you're overweight and that those fat cells are making estrogen and you're just exposed to estrogen chemicals, that you could actually be quite estrogen dominant and be in menopause, so you're not ovulating, but still have this excessive estrogen going on in your body.
And even when they do shrink, they shrink so darn slowly that it can be very frustrating for women.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's why it's so important to figure out what's going on and get the dietary changes and whatever changes else need to be made in your life, so you can kind of hit it off at the pass, so to speak. Okay, let's talk about polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, which is a big problem these days, actually.
Yeah, it sure is, and it has a big genetic component too. That doesn't mean there isn't a lot that we can do about it. There's a huge amount you can do about it, but it's been misunderstood for a long period of time and still is. Basically, the hallmarks of it are that a woman's likely to have irregular periods. She can go for months without having a period at all. She'll also notice that her skin is acting up. She might have acne, or she might have hair where she doesn't want it, or even hair loss, sort of a male pattern hair loss can occur. And in some cases, but not all, she can have polycystic ovaries. Now, that's where the name comes from, but not all women have that part of it. They don't necessarily have these cysts on their ovaries. But what all these things have in common is that they're driven by having just a little too much of the male sex hormones, what we would call androgens. You've got a little bit extra of that. That's going to make your periods irregular. It's going to cause your skin to act up, and it causes these polycystic ovaries. So what do we do about it? The first thing is it's very beneficial to get rid of any unwanted weight. For many women with PCOS, if they have some unwanted weight, they're able to trim it away. And by the way, I don't mean starve it off or do a ketogenic diet or any of that kind of stuff. What I would do is a healthy, low-fat, plant-based diet. That's a natural, gentle way to remove excess weight, but to do it very effectively. But then you want to go further, and we've talked about tackling hormones in a healthful way, using the steps that I mentioned earlier. But there's another side of this for PCOS, and that's your blood sugar can get out of control. Many women with PCOS have what we call insulin resistance. And that means your cells are not responding to insulin, right? Insulin normally escorts sugar, glucose, into the cells, and now the cells are insulin resistant. They're saying no, and the sugar can't get into the cells, and it builds up in the blood. And so doctors treat it the way they would treat diabetes. You've got a high blood sugar. And the same diet change helps with all of these things. So with polycystic ovary, we do all of the hormone controls, but we also are tackling the insulin resistance too.
How do you do that?
Here we have to take a new view of things, which, by the way, is critically important also for diabetes. And I should mention I'm hoping that anyone for whom diabetes or PCOS is an issue, I would ask them to stop checking their email and listen to this part of the interview. This is really important. The issue is not that you are eating rice or bread or starches or even drinking sodas. Many people will blame starch or sugar for diabetes or insulin problems. That's not the issue. What is the issue is if you look inside the cells of the body, something is building up inside the cell, and that something is tiny fat particles. And as fat particles build up, they cause insulin to not be able to control the cell anymore. It's sort of like if you went home from work and somebody had put chewing gum inside your front door lock. There's nothing wrong with your key, but it's not going to open up that door. The lock is all gummed up. Well, your cells are gummed up with fat. And so the insulin, which normally acts like a key that would normally open up the cells of the body, it can't do it because the cell is gummed up with fat. So in 2003, the U.S. government, as you mentioned in the introduction, the U.S. government funded my research team to find a better diet for diabetes. And it was a plant-based diet. It was very low in fat, very rich in vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains. And it was dramatically better than the best current diet at controlling blood sugar. And what it does is it removes the fat, the diet change removes the fat from your cells so that insulin can work again. And so we've seen people with diabetes improve dramatically, and also people with PCOS can improve. I described the story of a young woman named Allison, who is a registered dietitian in Wisconsin, who used this approach, and she had thought she was infertile. She knew she had PCOS, and she knew it was genetic because she wasn't the only one in her family who had it. But when she went on this approach, it helped her dramatically. It helped her to get her cycle back, and she actually got pregnant and has a baby now, and is improved enormously.
So with PCOS, there's a high androgen level. So you have testosterone-like hormones that are creating the hair growth and the skin outbreak and a lot of the symptoms associated with this particular hormonal balance. So what's that about? Where do the androgens come from? What's driving them?
All women have both androgens and estrogens, and they're in a certain balance, and in the same way as men have androgens and estrogens. In men, the androgens are testosterone in particular predominates. So that means that the man is going to have a whole beard and he's going to have a lower voice and all these things that come from testosterone. A man has estrogen in his body too, but very little. For a woman, it's the opposite. She has just a trace of testosterone, not enough for her to have hair on her chin or a low voice or to get bald or whatever, but she's got a lot of estrogen, so she'll have breast development and everything else. In polycystic ovary, it's not the diet, it's her genes that are causing her body to produce a little bit excess androgen, presumably from the adrenal glands that are sitting above the kidneys. And they just do it, but what a diet change can do is it can either accentuate that problem or it can tackle it a little bit. And in the tackling department, if a woman is on the healthy diet that I've been mentioning, a healthy, low-fat, plant-based diet, her body makes something, which is called SHBG, sex hormone binding globulin. A globulin is just a protein that circulates in the blood. And sex hormone binding globulin grabs a hold of that excess testosterone and just holds it inactive. And as long as the SHBG has hold of those testosterone molecules, they don't do anything. They're completely inactive. So, okay, let's say I've got PCOS. I've got too much testosterone. It's given me a little bit of chin hair or a little bit of a mustache, so I'm plucking my hairs out. My acne is noticeable, and I'm not ovulating and so forth. And I go on a plant-based diet. My SHBG level goes up. It grabs the testosterone, inactivates it, and helps me get better. That's not all it does. It will also help me lose weight, so my insulin resistance gets better. It helps drain the fat out of my muscle and liver cells, so my insulin will work better for that reason. And all of these things get better at the same time. I didn't change my genetics, and I still have PCOS, but I can be in dramatically better shape than I was before.
Well, so do you think all PCOS is a genetic factor, or is it environmental? Is it dietary that drives this insulin resistance pattern?
The short answer is yes. It's all of those. I think all of those things play a role. Genes pretty clearly do play a role with this, and their effect can be modulated by dietary factors. And I know that's a surprising thing, but it's amazing to see even conditions. Take an extreme condition like lung cancer, which is related to smoking. Even though diet has nothing to do with the cause of it, it can modulate it. There are certain dietary patterns that will make smoking-induced lung cancer more likely to occur, and others that will make it less likely to occur. So with PCOS, which does have a big genetic driver, diet changes play a role, and environmental factors play a role too. As you were mentioning earlier, there are chemicals we're exposed to that have estrogenic effects, and we have to presume there's been a fair amount of research in this suggesting that they may be playing a role too. But the easiest to control thing of all, and I'm going to argue the biggest source of quote-unquote chemicals, is what you're having for breakfast and what you're having for lunch and what you're having for dinner. The chemicals that you might inhale or might be in your water are measured in nanograms, but what's measured in your refrigerator is in kilograms. I'm talking about it's huge amounts of stuff that's going down our esophagus with our diet, and if we decided not to control that, then we're going to often suffer as a result.
And I often think about doing the genomic testing that I've done and understanding that food also is communicating directly to our genes. So we're having an epigenetic effect and altering how genes get expressed, not just giving them the key nutrients in foods, but the information in foods as well, which is why we have to go back to nature and do what we evolved with, which is eat real foods, real healthy, organic, primary foods. Which
yes,
is,
that's really true. And with that in mind, what those foods are, I think, is important, because there are some people who will say, that you should have milk from an organically raised cow, or have meat from an organically raised cow or chicken or something, and have it with vegetables and fruits and beans. But I would suggest really rethinking that. And I have to preface this by saying that I grew up in North Dakota, and my dad was a cattle rancher up until he was big enough to decide he didn't want to do that anymore. My grandfather and my great-grandfather, all my uncles and cousins, they all raised cattle. But there is no more processed food than meat and dairy. Now, that may sound funny. Why would roast beef be considered a processed food? The reason is you take soybeans or corn, and you put it out there, and the cow eats it. And those nutrients, the proteins and whatever is in the cattle feed, goes through the cow's digestive tract. It's all ripped apart. It's changed in a great many ways, and it is assimilated into muscle tissue or into milk. And then you milk the cow, and you take that milk out. All the nutrients that are in it came from the corn or the soybeans or whatever else it was, but are dramatically changed by this factory we call a cow. And then when it's turned into cheese, you have to add bacterial cultures to ferment it. Then you add rennet, which is a genetically engineered product, or else it's taken from a calf's stomach, to make it coagulate. Then you add a boatload of salt, and you make this product called cheese. And if you put a sufficiently European-looking label on it, people will imagine this is some wonderful historical product that's not really processed. It's the most you couldn't process soybeans and corn more effectively than feeding it to an animal, and the same is true with muscle tissue. If you're eating striated muscle, it came out of a cow, but it originated as crops that were massively processed through the animal's body. So an unprocessed diet is fruits and vegetables and whole grains and beans, things that you didn't process through a factory or through an animal. That's exactly the opposite of the way I grew up in Fargo. But that's a healthy diet, and luckily you can turn it into culinary masterpieces, whether it's an Italian pasta topped with tomato sauce, or Chinese vegetables and tofu, or an Indian curry, or Mexican bean burrito, or Japanese cucumber sushi, or whatever it is. There's a lot of ways of converting these things into delicious foods. But starting with these simple, basic foods gives you the best chance for good health.
And I just have to say, I have looked at the recipes in the back of your book, in the last section of your book, which is Your Body in Balance. They look pretty good to me, I have to say. You've created some amazing mouth-watering recipes here, which often people think on a more vegan type diet it's difficult to do, but you've done a great job.
The credit for the recipes really goes to Lindsay Nixon. Lindsay Nixon is a genius. She creates recipes with relatively few ingredients that are quick to make, so you can get out of the kitchen in 20-25 minutes or whatever. You're not slaving over the stove, but they're tasty and they're familiar. It can be pizzas and wraps and familiar things, but really well done. And when she sent me the recipes, she sent me a note, I have to tell you, which I included in the book, where she said, "Dr. Barnard, the eating pattern you're describing cured my menstrual pain too." So I thought, okay, that's validation.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, before we run out of time, let's talk to the men, or let's talk to the women who will talk to the men. Let's talk about some of the hormonal issues that are plaguing men and increasing their risk of prostate issues, prostate cancer, testicular cancer, gonomastia. Let's talk about that.
Sure. We mentioned already that sperm counts are affected by dairy. Researchers have found that the higher the cheese intake, the lower the sperm count. That's one thing. One thing I should mention that guys think is related to hormones but is not, and that's erectile dysfunction. So many guys are asking for a Viagra prescription, and here we have to make sure loud and clear that they understand that this is caused by atherosclerosis. A guy with erectile dysfunction, he's 50 years old, he's got erectile dysfunction, the doctor hands him a Viagra prescription, fair enough. But what the doctor has to say is your arteries have been narrowed by a lifetime of eating animal fat and cholesterol, and that's narrowing your arteries, and that's the reason you don't have adequate blood flow to your private parts to make it function. And the problem is that if you have it in your private parts, you also have it in your heart. And you also have narrowed arteries to your brain. So you are at much higher than average risk for a heart attack or stroke within the next 3 to 5 years. So patients with erectile dysfunction need to understand now is the time. This is a shot across your bow. Change your diet now and get the animal products out. And not only will you prevent the heart attack, but you also will very likely treat the erectile dysfunction, and it will go away. The same changes will help prostate cancer, which is a hormonal condition driven, we believe, by androgens to a degree. There's a genetic component, but not all men get it. Dairy products are the biggest issue here, according to the research that we're seeing. Milk-drinking men have substantially higher risk, probably because milk in the diet increases in a man's bloodstream the concentrations of a compound called IGF-1. Or insulin-like growth factor, number one. A man or woman who drinks milk has higher IGF-1 levels. IGF-1 in a test tube makes cancer cells grow like crazy. And that's true for prostate cancer cells. It's also true for breast cancer. There was, in fact, just a study out 2 weeks ago from Loma Linda University that milk-drinking women had 50% higher risk of breast cancer compared to other women.
Wow. That's a lot.
It's the IGF-1. It's the IGF-1. It's the estrogens. It's other things all put together. So for a man who wants to live well and live long, getting away from animal products is a good thing. It will get his hormones back into the right balance. It will allow him to function sexually. It will allow him to trim away unwanted weight. More lean, less flab. This is all a good thing.
Such important advice. That's this enlarged prostate issue is such a big problem for men. It's it's of great concern, but also it's obviously an early warning sign that things are really getting out of balance. They need attention, whatever that is in your life, and you start with diet for sure, and cleaning up your environment. That's true.
And there are some supplements that people are using too, and that can be part of the medical armamentarium for for prostate problems, saw palmetto has been used for a long time, although the evidence is now tipping probably toward another one called beta-sitosterol that patients can try. But these are to be used in addition to a healthy diet, not instead of it.
Right. So what are some of the other concerns about low testosterone levels? And how can men bring those testosterone levels up? Let's talk about the problems when you lose testosterone or when levels get low and how we can increase them, especially as you get older.
Well, I have to say, I think the biggest problem is the man thinking he has low testosterone and the doctor going along with this. There is a huge pressure on doctors now to prescribe this, and they invent a disease called low T. Nowadays, drug marketers are finding creative ways to market drugs, and they come up with clever names. Like, for example, metastatic breast cancer, they'll call it MBC, and to make it almost sound like KFC or something that you'd want to have. and I'm sorry to say that they're doing this with testosterone as well. So anyway, this doesn't mean that some men don't have lower testosterone levels. What I mean to say is that the vast majority of people seeing doctors for this really don't have a condition that's going to be treated effectively by administering testosterone. So what I mean by that is, in randomized trials, patients come in and they go to see the clinician and they are given testosterone and sort of nothing happens. And the patient says, well, you know, I was fatigued and I'm still fatigued and I don't feel as strong as I was. And you look at the patient and you discover their diet is not so hot and they are stressed and they're not sleeping well. And those are really the bigger issues for men than low T. So I'm personally concerned about the overprescription. And in our clinic, we never actually use testosterone.
Yeah, it's very trendy now, low T. What about,
do you believe
in andropause, you know, male menopause term? This has been created, you know, as another, I think, marketing strategy, but I'd like to hear your take on it.
No, I don't believe in it.
I mean, oh, good.
I think it is a marketing strategy, and marketers are great. I mean, and a similar one is for women, where women will be given a diagnosis of low sexual desire, and I understand that, I understand sort of the dynamics here, but the diagnostic criteria include that not only that you might be dissatisfied with your lack of sexual desire, or you can be diagnosed with it if your partner is dissatisfied. In other words, you might feel perfectly fine. You don't feel like having intercourse now, or maybe not at all. But if your partner is dissatisfied, then you have a disease. And I would argue that it's not for doctors to put their values on their patients. If the patient is concerned about this and wants to take action, fine. That's her prerogative. But let's not give her a disease label based on some cultural norm that may not apply.
Oh, good. I'm glad you said that. I think we're medicalized and pathologized much too often these days, and it really is just to promote the sale of certain drugs and strategies that can really be harmful for people. We've gotten so far off the track, right? We've strayed so far from nature, really, that we're looking for all these solutions that have more risks and more problems associated with it and made up conditions rather than understanding the needs of our body. So
yes, that's really the case.
You know, what else in the few minutes we have left, what else do you feel that is important to share with my audience today?
Maybe two things really quickly. One is mood. And the other is thyroid conditions. I dedicated chapters to each of these, and we stumbled into the mood thing completely by accident. The automobile insurance company, GEICO, has its national headquarters about four blocks from my office. And so I got to talking to the medical director over there, and we did a research study at GEICO. And what we did is we wanted to see if people could lose weight or if they had diabetes, if it could improve by changing their diet. And so what we did is we introduced a completely plant-based diet at GEICO, which meant bean chili instead of meat chili, or, you know, veggie burgers instead of hamburgers. And it worked great. You know, people lost weight, and if they had diabetes, they got better. However, we also tracked all kinds of other symptoms, including depression, including anxiety. And they got better, too. And we used these organized paper and pencil tests to evaluate mood, and we found that people were improving quite significantly. And at first we thought, well, this is just coincidence, or maybe because, you know, you're losing weight, naturally that's going to be a mood booster. But it wasn't just that. Job absenteeism was getting better, and other researchers found exactly the same phenomenon, that when people followed a plant-based diet, they seemed to get better. So what we think is happening is that foods affect the gut. The gut, in turn, feeds back to the brain. And the very best foods for healthy gut bacteria are the plant-based foods. Beans and vegetables and fruits and whole grains, all these old-fashioned things that we've kind of forgotten about. And the worst things are the meats and the dairy products and so forth. And by the way, lace up your sneakers. Get exercising. That's good for the mood, too, especially outdoors in the sun. And then with regard to the thyroid, we found that similar diet changes can help reduce the autoimmune attack on the thyroid that leads to Hashimoto's thyroiditis, that's low thyroid, or Graves' disease, which is high thyroid. If you include seaweed in your diet, you're getting nature's healthiest source of iodine, which your body uses to make healthy thyroid hormone. So we're starting to discover how foods can be used very creatively to tackle these common problems.
So you actually got Geico to implement these strategies with their employees, and then you track them and found these results.
Not only did we do this in a randomized trial, both in D.C. and then in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which served as the control group, but we also did it then in 8 additional cities because we wanted to see not just does it work. We wanted to see does it work with everyday folks in the workplace, and would it work if you're in Macon, Georgia, or Dallas, Texas, or Buffalo, New York? In all kinds of places where people have all kinds of dietary habits. And the answer is yes, it works in all those places. So you can do it. It's surprisingly easy to do.
Well, you're doing such incredible work, and you must really be satisfied because it could be really challenging to try to bring dietary changes and, you know, more natural or vegan type changes into these kinds of environments or to get funded to do these studies. So you're doing something really extraordinary that seems to be, you know, you're recognized and supported in doing this research, which really is, I think, unusual, don't you think?
You know, it's a bit of a team effort, and the whole world is rethinking its diet. People are rethinking it for various reasons. Many people are concerned about their health. They want to prevent cancer. They don't want to have another heart attack. So Dean Ornish showed that you can reverse heart disease. Others have shown that cancer survival can be improved by healthy eating. But then people are changing their diet to save the earth. You know, if you turned into the Golden Globes or the Academy Awards, the Oscars, the meal they serve for these people is vegan, and they felt ashamed if they had a chicken breast. You know, so the world is changing in a really good way. And then, of course, I have to say, my heart sings whenever I see a youngster saying, "I want to be vegetarian for the animals." I think you're going to be a darn good cardiologist one day. You know, when people change their diet because they've got the weight of the world on their shoulders. So I think all of these reasons work.
Well, I just want to thank you for your wonderful work and for all the great books you're putting together. So I encourage people to read Your Body in Balance, The New Science of Food, Hormones, and Health by Dr. Neil Bernard. And we have to go. So thank you so much for a wonderful conversation today. And what's the best website for people to go to?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Our website here is PCRM.org. That stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org.
Okay, wonderful, PCRM.org. Thank you, Dr. Neil Bernard, and thank you all. Always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.